The following is a Bachelor of Arts production.
Previously on the Supporting Act podcast.
Well, I could sit at home and watch Much Music, or I could go to this dance and watch Much Music.
This week on a very special Supporting Act podcast.
Yeah, I feel like based on his percentages, I could predict as well as Nostradamus.
You're listening to episode number 38 of the Supporting Act podcast, in which I sit down with comedian and podcaster Graham Clark. Stay tuned, you might learn something. You're listening to episode number 38 of the Supporting Act podcast. My name is Matt Moskal, I'll be your host. I'm a musician by trade, a journalist by education, and now and then I get insecure from all the pain. I'm so ashamed. I am beautiful no matter what they say. No words can bring me down. I am beautiful in every single way. No words can bring me down. So don't you bring me down today. If it's your first time listening to the show, this is the program where we illuminate the careers of musicians, comedians, artists just shy of the mainstream spotlight. We do so every week. It's an independent production produced entirely out of my house, the Llama House in Winnipeg, Manitoba, though sometimes I like to travel to far off places such as the Comedy Condo or the Purple Room to record interviews. We come out every Wednesday. It is, once again made by my own, dime out of my own pocket, from my pockets to your ears, this program is. And, we do so and, release it on Liberated Syndication, Stitcher Radio, sometimes on showbizmonkeys.com as well as, on Tumblr. Because I like, Tumblr. Can't think of a funny excuse this week. I'm just going to flat out say it. I don't like to put the effort into making websites, so I like Tumblr. Also, you can subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a star rating there. Leave some comments. I'm sure the host could use a pick-me-up every now and then. He's been singing a lot of Beautiful, as written by Linda Perry of Four Non Blondes and as performed by Christina Aguilera and Evan Dando of the Lemonheads a lot lately. My guest this week on the show is Graham Clark, a stand-up comedian based out of Vancouver, BC, originally from Calgary, Alberta. He is also one half of the Stop Podcasting Yourself hosting team, along with Dave Shumka. He is also part of an event called the Ring-a-Ding-Dong Dandy, which brings humor to professional wrestling by showing ridiculous clips and moments in the world of sports entertainment. Basically, Graham Clark is everything that every man aspires to be, in my books anyways. Which really isn't a joke, by the way. I went to go see Graham perform stand-up comedy at Rumors Comedy Club on Saturday night, and it was basically a room full of people that looked like they wanted to beat him up in high school, slamming their open hands on the table in laughter just from how much fun they were having listening to him take apart his body or his appearance and then take apart some of his favorite movies. And even he made jokes about vegetarianism where vegetarians weren't the butt end of the joke. So I found that extremely fascinating, and it's the kind of comedy that I think is good for mankind. So let's go now to my interview with Graham Clark, stand-up comedian and podcaster.
Bas-
basically, we can talk about whatever the hell we want.
Ah, look at us, living in the free world.
That's right.
We can do whatever we want.
Exactly. It's the 21st century and we are in Canada, so we can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, we're free to make our own decisions, to chart our own destiny, etc.
Etc. Unless, of course, that destiny includes, like, murder or...
Yeah, no, that's true. We still do have laws, even though it's a free country. Yeah. There's still laws, regulations, rules.
That's right. The CRTC would not be happy with us murdering people, I don't think.
Yeah, you know, well, them and others, right?
Right.
CRTC yeah. And then also... The, you know, judges and
yeah,
cops, yeah. The cops,
the general public,
yeah, the people who are being murdered,
anybody,
etc., etc., etc.
Anybody who follows Hammurabi's code, you know.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Taking it back to pre-biblical times, I think. With that,
very good.
Yeah,
very good.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's what they started teaching us in Canadian high school. Was like I knew
biblical law.
Like, I knew about, like, Nostradamus before I knew about the First World War in, like, high school.
Really?
Yeah, that's where we started. It was like...
Did you go to high school?
I went to high school in southern Ontario, so I was, like, in Ingersoll, which is, like, just kind of like a cow town outside of London, Ontario.
Why were you learning about Nostradamus?
I think it was because the idea that history is written by the victors... And so Nostradamus was an example of if you took the quatrains and you read them and you interpreted him as someone who could predict the future,
right?
Then that's just one perspective of his words. Or you could just literally read them as nothing but random poems that he came up with, and that he was just a drug addict weirdo that happened to be right occasionally.
Yeah, I feel like based on his percentages, I could predict as well as Nostradamus.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I just sat around making predictions all day, one of them eventually would come true, right?
Yeah.
If you just kept predicting and predicting and predicting, which I think he did, right?
Yeah.
Didn't he just predict like a ton of stuff?
No, exactly. He just kind of sat there with a pen writing things out, and I'm sure that guy is out there right now and like, a dorm room.
Yeah, some guy named Ted.
Yeah, and Ted's just taking bong rips and then just like, I think that there will be a storm and like the world has never seen in 4 years. And they're like, Ted, shut up and, you know, fire up the Xbox 360. Come on, let's go. It's Halo time.
But it's, you know, he's right. There will be a storm, like, you know, at some point.
Yeah.
So he doesn't, you know what I mean? Like, you could, I don't know.
No,
it seems like easy to predict the future.
Yeah, the future is unwritten, but it's also like kind of predictable. I don't think that we live under rules, so we live under a complete lack of true. It's like there's only so many colors on the spectrum. No one has invented or discovered a new color.
Oh, that's true.
So I mean, it's kind
except
of like
the mantis shrimp.
Oh,
they can see other colors that we don't even know exist.
Really? That's a thing?
Yeah, yeah. They've got like a color visual range that's, it's the most advanced of any animal on Earth. They can see colors in things that we can't.
Well, I retract my previous statement. I actually truly believe now that there's possibilities that we don't know how to comprehend. Wow. And speaking of comprehending things that are a little bit outside of our realm,
sure.
You must get this a lot, but I'm just genuinely curious about it. This was one of those things I read in an interview, and the record skipped, and that was at the age of 14. You wrote an episode of Seinfeld, right?
Yeah.
So, what was it about your 14-year-old perspective that you tried to match wits with Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld? Like, what did you think you were going to bring to the table on that?
That's a good question. I don't know. I thought I loved the show. I was in love with the whole stand-up thing. And then when there was a TV show about a stand-up comedian, it was so mind-blowing that was like a thing. It was like they reached into my head and like said, what are the things you'd like to be on a show, and just kind of put them all together, and that was Seinfeld. And so I read things about like young Woody Allen would write and send in you know, jokes and script ideas to people, and it was just seemed like a thing that you just did.
Yeah.
You just started, and to just do it was the thing. So I don't think I thought I added anything to it. I just think that was the thing you did to try and be in show business.
Yeah.
You wrote a script and you sent it in.
Do you remember what your ideas were on that in that script? Do you remember what that episode was about?
I don't remember like what the script was about. I remember that at one point there was a slinky was involved somehow, because I remember like Jerry was like, he was really fond of like old timey toys and stuff like that. So I wrote something about a slinky, but that's all I really that's the only thing that sticks out from it.
See, that's funny because it being a show about nothing, you could pretty much just say like '90s reference, '90s reference, '90s reference. How did the gang get through that? Like, Like I just read about the episode. I think it was originally titled "The Bet." It was in season two. I think it was supposed to come after the Pony Remark episode.
Okay,
and it was the episode where Elaine gets a gun that they ended up not making because it was too dark.
There was no way to make gun ownership funny.
Yeah,
they said. Yeah, that's interesting because I feel like then The Simpsons did an episode about a gun and it's hysterical. It was really, really funny. So I don't know. It's weird that they would back down from a topic or an issue, you know, because they had so much goodwill towards the show. They really could have done something, you know, pretty lasting about guns and gun control and stuff like that, but I guess maybe they thought it was outside of their realm, you know? But they could have done a show about a slinky, so that's what I wrote.
They covered some dark topics. I mean, I remember like George. Spoiler alert: George's wife is poisoned, and like
And there was, you know, there's like references to like depression and, you know, alcoholism and
drug addiction as well was brought up in the itchy sweater episode. And
And all manner of things they took on. And it seems weird that guns were a thing that it was outside of their realm, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's too bad because they were on... they were on one end of when the internet kind of started. They were at the very... their show was ending just as the internet became, like, huge. I'd like to know what those writers would have said about, like, our life and the internet now, you know?
Yeah.
I don't feel like there's been a show that's, like, captured that the same way that Seinfeld captured all the 90s stuff.
No, there hasn't.
Right?
I feel like... cell phones just feel like such a shortcut in scripts, though, as well. Like, there's all these articles online about how a movie would be completely different if cell phones were introduced. So, like,
it's
Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes would have had a completely different ending if the two of them would have been able to text message and clarify things.
It's true, but then you see, like, a show... have you ever seen House of Cards?
I have not watched House of Cards.
So they use texting very effectively in it. So I think like that's a weird thing that writers haven't been able to get their head around when it comes to cell phones and stuff. Like in horror movies, all the cell phones have to be lost or disabled in order. But that seems to be the only way they could write through it instead of just making a new kind of horror movie that, you know, depends on having a cell phone. Being stalked on a cell phone would be scary. I don't know. I've never written a horror movie, but, you know, it feels like you could use the phone as a tool.
Yeah.
But they just kind of eliminate it, and then they go with the old-timey, you know, we're locked in a cabin in the woods or whatever.
Exactly. They have to find the shortest way to get rid of technology because technology is a wrench in their gears.
Yeah, totally.
Ironically enough.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, it feels like maybe kids who have grown up with the technology their whole life, they'll be able to write the new style. of a show or movie or whatever that has phones in it because they've lived with phones their whole life, so it'll just be incidental. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know. Well, I have to wait and see.
We'll have to wait. Yeah. We'll have to see what happens. I just thought of, like, does that mean House of Cards is in a way like the person behind House of Cards could write the Seinfeld of our generation if they applied that logic to comedy? Is that possible?
It's very possible.
What's the name of that animal again? The jumbo.
The mantis shrimp.
The mantis shrimp. Yeah. Do you think he's the mantis shrimp of scriptwriters?
He might be.
Yeah. He's seeing things that we can't.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's like, you know, the text message is used like a text message is in real life. You know.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, like it's not just like the way you would write just like a phone call, except now it's a cell phone.
Yeah.
Like it's actual, you see the text on the screen and it's part of the plot, you know? So, yeah, maybe. Maybe that guy, if he applied it to comedy, could be the next Seinfeld.
I think comedy is harder to write though than tragedy in so many ways because
I think
we naturally gear our brains towards look at Robin Williams, for example. I know everyone's been talking about this all week.
Yeah.
And everyone has kind of put their two cents in to the point where like a day after it happened, my thoughts weren't I need answers. My thoughts were I have more answers than I'm ever going to need about this.
Right. Yeah.
We just tend to gravitate towards tragedy because everyone can relate to that.
Yeah.
And we don't all laugh at the same things, but I think we find the same things very sad.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the whole, you know, Robin Williams thing was so shocking because he, even though everybody knew that he was a guy who dealt with depression or whatever, that he was such a light figure.
Yeah.
You know, he just wouldn't have been somebody you would have thought would do something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, you know, silly of us to you know what I mean? Like, of course, a guy who's struggled with depression his whole life, that's the exact guy.
Yeah.
But I think it was just so shocking because he's just always been there. You know, he's been around my whole life, you know, in one form or another, and he's like an endearing figure. And you just don't think about him as a dark, you know, that he had this depression and darkness around him. He didn't show that, you know, in a lot of his work. So, so people were shocked, you know, and I think not rightly so, but I'm not surprised that people were shocked. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, it goes down to the very basics of it. It's one of your favorite Disney characters. The comic relief in an otherwise like heavy story about a poor guy who falls in love with royalty.
Right.
And has to, you know, basically fight for his life in order to marry her, has to save both of their lives.
That's
a pretty heavy story without a genie popping in and out and, you know, singing and.
That's true. Yeah, it's very true. And it's also, you know, he was in a lot of kids movies, so he's you know, somebody that people were exposed to as kids and grew up with him, you know, from Popeye to Jumanji to, you know, Aladdin. Like, that's a bunch of different generations of kids growing up with him as a fixture, you know? And so that's another thing. Like, I think everybody's connected to him in this very specific way, you know? Yeah. And so it's like, it's like reaching into your childhood kind of thing.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, seeing as a tragedy, like, obviously draws us all in and we can't help but look or we can't help but want to read more when it comes to tragedy. When it comes to writing comedy, starting with a script is something I find interesting. Did you write the script before you started writing your first stand-up bits, or which came first in that situation?
It was all around the same time. I was just doing, that's what I was fascinated with, was just comedy.
Yeah.
So I was writing jokes and I was writing, you know, ideas for a movie or ideas for a show or just anything, you know, an idea for a sketch, just anything that I thought was funny. that was my focus when I was a teenager. I just thought like that was the most important thing was comedy. And I was lucky. I had some people around me that were good and supportive of that. But yeah, I was writing material and scripts and everything all kind of all at the same time.
Yeah. You had like a different notebook for every individual thing or?
No, you know, it's just like a hodgepodge, you know? Like, my friends and I would work on comic strips together, like, and we, you know, made comic books and, yeah, it was just always comedy, comedy, comedy was the thing, you know? And then like, even just watching something like Seinfeld or Saturday Night Live and then getting together with friends the next day and just going over our favorite jokes and bits. I think that's the same. I think most comedians had that at some point. They had just like a group of guys that all liked being funny or liked comedy.
Yeah.
And so it was just constant. It was in all the notebooks, you know, it was just everything all the time.
Yeah. I remember my notebook for, high school mathematics was like, I'd go to the back page if I was going to write like song lyrics or a joke or a short story idea or whatever, or like an idea for a movie or something. And then it got to be that the back of the binder, crept up, and I think I was like going through like trigonometry homework or something, and I turned one page, and on one side of the page it was all these equations, and on the other side of the page was like this idea for a children's movie or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's all encompassing, you know?
Yeah. It's just this, it's very stream of consciousness at the time, because it's almost like you see people who succeed in that field, but you're not, it's considered something that daydreamers do, because there's no classes in high school for comedy. There's no classes in high school. There's theater, but even
then, that's right. Yeah, you gotta seek it out. I mean, I have friends that like in high school they did have, there was like improv classes, but that never existed when I was in school.
No.
It was like you say, it was like theater. And if you didn't get into the play, then there was nothing. There was no secondary thing. So it was just, you had to kind of invent your own thing, whatever it was. If it was putting on sketches with your friends or just talking about comedy all the time, you had to just find it yourself.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. There's no club for it.
There's no comedy club in.
No. I mean, probably there is now. It's probably much easier with the, with the internet to find like-minded people all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, but when I was a teenager, there wasn't, just didn't exist. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The internet was in its infancy. It was message boards and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's more people that grew up with the kind of things we grew up with, though. I mean, like, first of all, one factor I find with a lot of comedians or a lot of funny people, especially in Canada, is there's a funny family kind of behind them. Like, for example, so many people's folks let them stay up late on a Saturday night to watch SNL. Even though every other night they had to be in bed by a certain hour, or so many times you'd be watching TV at whatever hour of the afternoon and you'd see Just for Laughs, because that was something that CBC seemed to run every hour on.
Yeah,
the hour.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, did you come from sort of a supportive background in that regard in terms of your aspirations to do comedy? Or?
Yeah, being like funny was really, it was held up pretty high in the household.
Yeah.
And, we used to watch Seinfeld, like we used to watch Seinfeld as a family.
Yeah.
Every week, and we would like, we were all, my dad was a really big comedy fan. My mom's a big comedy fan. I have, you know, really funny uncles. So, like, comedy was always big. It was always a positive thing in the household. And so, it was easy to kind of, like, aspire to that, you know, when you're watching the show together every week. You're like, I want to be on the other end of that. I want to be the person making everyone laugh. So, that was kind of my first probably, like, dose of knowing that, you know, comedy was like an important thing, or feeling like comedy was an important thing, and that came from the family for sure. And they were from the get, when I decided that I wanted to do comedy, they were super supportive always. So
yeah, there's a quote. One of the reasons I think comedy kind of felt like it was kept out of institutions was because it's a very anti-institutional form of self-expression. Like,
right.
There's a quote I really like from Matt Groening, creator of The Simpsons, and he said, "When the authorities warn you that of the dangers of having sex, there is an important lesson to be learned. Do not have sex with the authorities."
Right.
Which is, like, he has on record many times said, like, the whole point of shows like The Simpsons was to take, you know, you see the church, you see the principal, you see all the people that sort of talk down to you when you're younger, and the people who sort of set the rules and the guidelines, right. And they're all just as absurd and silly as the people that, you know, as your peers, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you find yourself sort of, in sort of a position of being anti-authority at any point in time? Or did you find yourself sort of poking holes in the veneer, so to speak?
I think, you know, when I was growing up, I was really attracted to, I was really into, punk music, cause that was a big thing in Calgary when I was growing up. And this kind of do-it-yourself culture was very, like, it was very appealing to me. It was kind of, independent films were just kind of coming of age. They were kind of new on the scene, and people were excited about them. And punk music was that same kind of thing. Like, you found your own venue, and you brought your own crowd. And
yeah.
And so comedy just seemed like that was just a fit. Like, that was just another piece of that.
Yeah.
Puzzle. Because yeah, like comedy clubs and the comedian, it seemed like their role to be, kind of on the outside looking in. And, I felt like that matched with all the other things at the time that I was really into.
Yeah.
So yeah, like the, like I'm not, you know, my comedy is not, you know, like I don't go on political rants or anything like that. But it still feels like it's the outsider looking in like that. And I think that's where comedy lives, you know. If, once you're in, it's not, you don't have that same perspective anymore. It's not as funny once you're the popular kid. You know what I mean? Your perspective on things is skewed.
Yeah.
You're no longer looking at the whole picture. You're looking at the picture through a certain tint, you know?
Exactly.
So it's tough. It's tough for comedians when they become huge, you know? I don't know how you write. I don't know how you get the outsider's perspective when you're selling out a stadium or whatever.
Yeah.
Because you're the insider now.
Yeah.
And, but maybe because that's such a rare, rarefied air, maybe that is an outsider's perspective. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, once you kind of become the institution, it's hard to poke fun at the institution, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know, there's a lot of comedians when they get to that level that they just stop doing stand-up. And, you know, which is too bad because I'd like to know what, you know, Eddie Murphy has to say about being famous, or, you know, Roseanne says she's coming back and doing some stand-up. I'd love to hear
her talk about, like, text messaging, or talk about just like how you want to see Seinfeld in the modern age and
dealing with
technology and everything. I want to hear Chris Rock talk about Facebook messages.
Yeah. And luckily we have, like, Chris Rock and Seinfeld still do it and tour and, but you know, a lot of these great comics kind of stop doing comedy. When they got to a certain level.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd love to see, you know, kind of Steve Martin do his thing now, you know?
And he's aching to do it. Like, if you see his late night talk show appearances, he's absolutely hilarious in an interview format.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the comics, they want to go back on, but they face this kind of, you know, I don't know. I think they face, like, their own kind of super ego, you know? Like, it wasn't easy for Dave Chappelle to get back on stage and do tours because people were yelling out stuff from the Chappelle show, right? Yeah. And that's not, you know, that's not where comedy happens.
No.
You know what I mean?
That's not where any good artistic expression happens.
Yeah.
I remember going to see, like, Matthew Good do a show, and people were yelling out, like, apparitions at him, like, every 5 minutes.
Yeah, and that kind of, like, you know, and that's the thing, too, is when you get to that level, you have to do a bit of the
yeah,
classic stuff and some of the new stuff, I think. But I don't know, like a guy like Louis C.K., he retires his act every year or whatever.
Yeah.
But I wonder, I wonder if people, like if you went to go see, you know, Steve Martin, and he was doing a stand-up comedy thing and he didn't do any banjo thing or Wild and Crazy Guy or whatever, yeah, would people leave feeling like they didn't get their money's worth, right?
People just rioting outside of the venue like, he didn't do Wild and Crazy Guy. And
well, that's like Monty Python did those shows, yeah, at the, which it's just like, here's what you want. Like, yeah, here's us doing the sketches that you want us to do. And I don't know anybody who watched it, but I wonder if it was, if yeah, that was good. You know?
Yeah. Well, like the kids in the hall keep going back on tour, and one of the big things they do is they'll write new material for old characters, but they won't revisit a lot of the same sketches.
Which is a, like, totally unique way of doing it. I think they're probably the only kind of group around that does something like that, where it's, like you say, like it's adding new life to favorite characters kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's a good model. I don't know why more people don't do it.
Exactly. It would be, it's kind of fun to see where, like, that's something the British have over us at all times. It's like those Christmas specials that'll come out a couple years after a series ends. You get to see where this character wound up, or you'll get to revisit them and see them in a different light.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. It's not part of the American kind of system.
Yeah.
We don't have that. Like, once a thing's done, although the Royal Canadian Air Force seem to have like a New Year's special
every year.
Yeah.
I just got the visual when that show ended. I was like, they'll be back. Like, they'll be back immediately. They have nowhere else to go.
It was weird to me that it ended at all, because I feel like the same people who watched it were still watching it.
Yeah.
It was weird. It was like, you know, it wasn't like, oh, this is getting stale. Like, I don't know that mattered to the audience that watched it loved it.
Yeah.
So I don't understand why it went off the air.
No, it doesn't make much sense to me.
That's show business though, you know?
I think it was one of those things where a lot of the members of the troupe were ready to retire, and I don't think they wanted to just hand the title of the show down to a new generation, so they just kind of put the kibosh in it and that was it.
That would be weird. That would be weird. It will be weird when Lorne Michaels decides to retire.
Yeah.
And give, cause the last time that he gave the reins over on Saturday Night Live, like the whole thing went into a tailspin. And I don't know, like I have no idea how much day to day input he has, but it'll be weird when he decides like, okay, I'm done. Yeah. Right? You know, And I've never thought about that until this very moment, that like, eventually he'll retire, but the show's not going to retire with him because it still has to keep going.
Yeah, the show didn't end when Will Ferrell left. The show didn't end when Belushi left.
The show didn't end
when Bill Murray left.
So it's going to be weird because Lorne's been the common thread, you know, through all those years. Except the Dick Ebersol years, but
we don't speak about
that. Yeah. People don't, you know? They really had a bad time there.
Yeah.
But that'll be a strange time.
It's gonna be one of those things that we all kind of mourn. And that's what's amazing about this day and age. What's amazing about this day and age too is that, the writers now, like, someone like Conan O'Brien, for example, he was writing some of our favorite Simpsons episodes, and the next thing you know, he's hosting a late night show, and the next thing you know, like, the possibility of losing him as a voice in our culture came up, and, like, people got enraged by it.
Yeah.
And now it's like I think we place more emphasis on writers and on producers or on directors than ever, because we kind of get to see behind the veil of what they're trying to, not from what they're trying to keep from us, but now we can see how the well-oiled machine works. Like there was that, for example, I'm not a South Park guy. I don't really care for it.
But, right.
They had that documentary where they turned out an episode in the span of a week, and that's what they do in their production season.
Yeah.
And that is an amazing, like, workshop in just how show business can work. You can animate an entire show, make a completely relevant reference to something that just happened, have a script that's, to its audience, absolutely hilarious. You know, presented, recorded, and then out in the span of a week.
Yeah. It's a different time. And like you say, the access to, through Twitter or through Facebook, to these people that you never ever would have had access to before is like pretty readily available. So you do get to see that whole world, because it was forever. It was just it was kind of a mystery, or it was what the producers and stuff wanted you to see, and no more. And now you've seen everything, and I wonder if there's any. You know, is there anything, any magic left in it? You know, like you've seen all of it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. At the end of this conversation, entertainment as we know it is done. We've hit the bottom.
Yeah. So, you know, when you kind of like, you know, Conan was on, like you said, he was, there was a kind of a big, push to get him to stay around. And then they made a documentary about him, and it was very kind of like warts and all kind of documentary. And, there's, you can easily access him.
Yeah.
But you couldn't do that with Johnny Carson or even David Letterman, like, cause David Letterman's from another generation. You can't tweet at David Letterman and have him respond to you. You know what I mean? Like that world is gone.
Yeah.
Now there's no celebrity that you can't, you know what I mean? You can't.
Yeah. Now we have like Marc Maron just like, you damn kids don't understand a fucking thing.
But it's just a different world now, you know?
And in terms of that accessibility, I was talking to Mark Forward about this, and on the show, and we were discussing the idea that, because of that accessibility though, people who aren't nearly as outgoing can still be considered very prolific, and it's almost like the sort of hidden gem is not so hidden anymore. Someone who's even not as socially active could still be considered prolific, and even just like we wouldn't get like another Nick Drake in so many ways because even the most antisocial people have like podcasts, or even like the most antisocial people have a Twitter account.
Yeah, that's true.
And so because of that, like, I mean, you've been podcasting for nearly a decade now, a few years shy of a decade, right?
A few years shy of a decade, yeah.
Yeah, which is remarkable, because it's hard to believe the format's even that old at this point in time,
yeah.
Right?
It is, yeah. It's weird. We didn't think we would do it. I don't know what our plan was. I think maybe we thought we would do it 10 times. And that was it. And then now it's, you know, 300 odd episodes. So, but that's, I don't know, that's the thing. Like, that's how everything in comedy should be done. It should be done because you want to do it.
Yeah.
And then if it catches, that's great. If it doesn't catch, it's not as great, but it's fine because you wanted to do it anyways.
Yeah, it's the best kept secret.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. Like, there's not, you know, it's not the same kind of, discovering, like you say, kind of a diamond in the rough, cause there's just not that much rough anymore. You know what I mean? It's all stripped away. So it's, like finding that kind of, hidden genius where it was like, oh, you had to know where to hear it or know how to get it. Those days are gone. Those days are totally gone. Yeah.
They're never coming back.
One thing I really love about what you guys do on the show, for me is, it's actually, I'm gonna keep name dropping, so just tell me
you
when enough is enough.
You go right ahead.
When I talked to, Colt Cabana, who you've had on the show as well.
Yes.
He brought up, one of his favorite things about doing his show is that whether he's sitting across from, Steve Austin, or he's sitting across from Ricochet, or he's sitting across from, you know, Chris Hero or whoever.
Right.
In the end, they're all just wrestlers. There's no ties. So you could have, like, Paul F. Tompkins on your show one week.
Right.
And then a comedian from Vancouver that, like, no one else outside of maybe Canada or even outside of Vancouver has ever heard of.
Yeah.
Is the booking process for you, is it partially who you want, or is it who is available most of the time?
We kind of go with who we think will be fun.
Okay.
That really is it. Like, we've had opportunities to book more famous acts that we just thought their style and our style isn't the same. It wouldn't necessarily gel. And yeah, like, we've just gone with that. We've gone with who's going to be fun to talk to for an hour plus.
Yeah.
You know? And because that's it. Like, everything else, if they're well-known, you know, maybe a few more people will listen. But really, if it's fun, that's what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to make it. Yeah, so that's basically our whole criteria is, will they be fun, or do we think they'll be fun on the podcast?
How appropriate that you're part of Maximum Fun. For that reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I just saw your eyes roll on that
one. No, we are, that's it. That's it. We did it because it was a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
And it still has to be fun.
Yeah.
Because otherwise there's no reason to do it.
You wouldn't have done it 333 times if it wasn't fun. Like, it's not sticking your finger into a light socket.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I mean, I've heard of people who have done different projects and it was fun to start and then diminishing returns, and they did it either because there was money was involved or they were expected to keep doing it. And I don't think we would. I think if it wasn't good and fun, we just wouldn't, I don't think we would keep doing it. So that's the main criteria going forward, is that it has to be enjoyable to do, because otherwise it's not going to be enjoyable to listen to. So,
I keep a list of 100 people I want to interview before I or they die.
Oh, nice!
Do you guys have a sort of a similar thing where you have people that, for sure, you know, if that opportunity comes up, you have to talk to that person? Or
I don't think we do. I mean, we've been lucky. We've got an opportunity to do a lot of do shows with a lot of the people we wanted to do shows with. There's some people that it would be great to have as guests, but I don't think either of us, at one point I think we comprised a list of all the people, both locally and in Canada, and, you know, that we thought would be good for the show.
Yeah.
And we got everybody on that list, you know, eventually. So.
Ah, damn it.
But, you know, like, it's probably a good idea to, I mean, there's certain people, like you say, if the opportunity came up, absolutely, we would love to have them. But I don't think we think of it in that same way. Yeah. But maybe we should. That's not a bad idea to kind of have a list to shoot for, you know?
Just like, I mean, obviously, like, number one on my list would probably be, like, Bill Murray.
Oh, well, yeah, that would be
But I don't
amazing.
Think Bill Murray is going to be stumbling through town anytime soon, and...
You never know. That's the great thing about Bill Murray, is you have no idea. He may be stumbling through town, and...
He could be waiting right behind that door.
Yeah,
right
exactly.
Now.
That's the type of guy Bill Murray is, you know? I think he likes having a crazy, unpredictable life. So that's doable to me. That sounds like it's doable.
Yeah. Do you feel like at one point in time that something just snaps in you, like, psychologically, and you're just like, I should just do whatever the fuck I want at this point?
I think for Bill Murray, I think he always was that.
Yeah.
All the kind of, like, interviews I read about him from even back at the very beginning of the SNL days.
Yeah.
He did whatever the fuck he wanted. And that's just his life. Like, I think that's how he's led his life. I think he always does what he wants, and you know, we get to enjoy hearing about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't think he got to a point. I think he was always at that point. He's just always been there. Yeah.
Shit, that must be a beautiful way of going about life. Just showing up at somebody's like wedding photos. And just not taking away from it, but adding to it so much more.
But I think he would, if he wasn't famous, he would still be doing that stuff. You know what I mean? He'd be sneaking into places. And I have friends like that.
Yeah.
That's just in their DNA. You know, they just think, oh, you know, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
And then they do these crazy things because, they don't have that same kind of thing in their brain saying, no, you can't, no, you can't, you know? And I don't think Bill Murray has that in his head.
No. Are you worried that you overthink things? Like, are you the kind to sort of make a spontaneous choice like that?
No, I always think, I always try and think of the repercussions.
Yeah.
I would just be so scared of showing up somewhere like what he does.
Yeah.
And just having people be like, oh, we don't want you here. You know what I mean?
Please, sir, we're going to have to ask you to leave.
Yeah, I don't have that kind of confidence that he has, so.
But then again, like, neither of us have been in Ghostbusters, so.
No, that's true. That's true. And if I had been in Ghostbusters, maybe I would have a little more self-confidence.
Yeah, but I don't think he walks around, like, there was an SNL sketch that was like, it wasn't a digital short, but it was sort of a weird extension of the show they did one time, and it was Neil Armstrong. And it was him going to, like, get groceries.
I remember that sketch.
And he's the whole time, and it's in his head, and he's like, I went to the moon, damn it! Moon!
I walked on the moon, yeah.
And then he's drinking, and he's staring up at it, and he's like, that's my bitch.
Bill Murray knows that he's Bill Murray.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And he, like... You know, George Clooney knows he's George Clooney. So they can just go and they can just do this type of thing and they know that people are gonna like it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. They're some other form of person that they're hyper confident.
Yeah.
And,
they're self-aware almost. Like they're so aware of what.
Yeah.
What people perceive their lens of reality to be. So they're not afraid to sort of introduce it in situations that it might not call for it,
yeah,
just to see what the reaction is.
And I think, I think you're right. Like, I think they're not head in the clouds kind of people, although it would seem like that would be a natural fit.
Yeah.
I don't think they are. I think you're right. I think they're like hyper aware of what is, you know? And, that's why they, you know, they nail it so often when they show up somewhere. These people, you know, they're not afraid that the Make-A-Wish kid isn't gonna want to see them or whatever, you know? Like, they hit the nail on the head every time.
Bill Murray, I wanted John Cena, damn it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. Too many Make-A-Wish, wishes coming true in that case. It's hard to hate a guy when all of his fans are sick and ailing children.
Yeah, that's true. It always, whenever you see, I don't know, it always gets me. Whenever I see somebody doing the Make-A-Wish thing or responding to a child's request, it's just, it always gets me.
It
works 100% of the time.
It's because it's not as tragic as an elderly person. This person is supposed to have their whole life in front.
And that, you know, somebody who's like a super famous person, they're like super busy all the time and they carve out this time in their schedule and to go do this. Like, what was the one that Ron Perlman, like, he like did the full makeup to Hellboy for a kid.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's like an hour three in a chair getting the makeup done to go visit this kid, but, you know, what are you gonna do? If you've got that power, you have to do it, right?
Yeah.
But I imagine there's a lot of celebrities that don't, and anyway, so whenever it happens, I'm always just like, it always gets me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by your charity project. I know you talk about it a lot in interviews because it's the elephant in the room. But you make paintings with your beard, which started as like these Jackson Pollock, like almost like splatters.
To, yeah.
Like, now they're full on formed pictures of Frankenstein taking a selfie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I haven't done it for a while just because
too many people were asking you questions about it.
I just got busy with other stuff, but now I'm working on a series.
Okay.
It'll be, for sale soon. And, I sell them through eBay and, I give all the money to like charity fundraising projects, stuff like that. And, so I'm going to sell this new series soon. And, it's a good hobby. You know, it's just it's a hobby for me. And by not making money a part of it, I've kept it a hobby.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, cause then I only do what I want to do and the type of paintings I want to do and whatever inspires me I can do. And sometimes I do commissions, but, mostly it's been, just whatever I want to paint. And that's what keeps it kind of fun, you know? Cause otherwise, if you're doing it for money, anything you do for money becomes unfun at a point. So.
Exactly. But when that money is going towards helping people, like, I can only imagine there's a smile on your face that's like, yeah, starving children.
Yeah. It's nice. It gives me, you know, it gave me kind of an excuse to do it because it was such a weird thing. Having the charity mechanism in there made it more, or made it easier for me to kind of sell the idea.
Yeah.
Cause, you know, then it wasn't just doing something weird for weirdness sake. You know, it was, there was some kind of point or goal involved, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just can't get past this visual of like this painting, whatever this process looks like.
I use the beard, I grab it,
okay.
And I use it like a paintbrush.
For those who are listening at home, he's grabbed the tip of his beard and twisted it slightly.
Yeah, yeah, and I use kind of a different bunch of like waxes and stuff to get it to various points.
And for those of you at home, he just made a tiny bee with his two fingers.
And then I use water-based paint.
Yeah.
And that washes out really easy and, yeah.
Yeah. I just love the concept of an absurd task making the world a better place.
Like, yeah, that's comedy in a nutshell.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, hopefully it's.
Yeah. Well, that's another part about the sort of anti-establishment, nature of comedy and, sort of as a student of comedy, one thing I've noticed is like, no matter how open-minded some people are as comedians, they'll still sort of take shots at things like veganism or,
right.
Vegetarianism or one thing I particularly have been against like since day one is I hate the word hipster being used as like the butt end of a joke.
Right.
It's,
yeah.
It's to me, it's all communities of appreciation that just, you know, they all care. People care enough about something to dedicate an aspect of their life to it. So long as nobody's being hurt by their behavior, I don't understand what the point of going, look at how tacky and silly this person is looking.
Sure.
Yeah, it's silly, but like, it's still kind of bullying to, you know, to be like, if you do this, fuck you, basically.
Right.
Over something as trivial as like fashion or, I don't know, the way people consume music or whatever.
Yeah. Easy targets.
Yeah.
There's always easy targets. You know, if it was, you know, comedy in the 60s, it was very easy to make fun of hippies.
Yeah.
And, you know, onward. Like, it's always, there's always easy targets. And I always, reflect on, like, a friend of mine when I was first starting comedy named Morgan Brayton.
Okay.
She's a sketch performer and, she, you know, I don't know what I had a joke about. It was either about, a fat person or a, you know, whatever. It was something. And she said it wasn't even that it wasn't funny. That was kind of beside the point is that it was lazy.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. You know, I think if you're taking shots at, kind of a minority of people, whatever that minority consists of, it's lazy. It's easy.
Yeah.
Because you know that the crowd already has a predisposition to look down their nose at that group.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it is. It's lazy comedy. And, every comedian at some point in their career is, guilty of it.
Of course.
But yeah, you overcome that.
Yeah.
You know, the good comedians always do. They just kind of figure out that, you know, you should be taking shots at, you know, the big targets.
Nobody from the government's going to be at a comedy show and be like, you can't say that, and then, like, whisk you off to the back room and, like, cap
exactly.
you in the head with a, you know, 9mm with a silencer. Putting a silencer to its appropriate use, I guess. But, like, you've written jokes from the perspective of being a vegetarian, right?
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, some people have their criticisms of vegetarianism, but, sure. I mean, like, It would be too easy to, and it would be untrue to just walk out there and be like, I'm a vegetarian. I know. You know,
so. But it is, that's the, you know, the audience, like you have to meet them halfway on it.
Yeah.
You know, nobody wants a lecture when they're at a comedy club. And, you know, sometimes you see comedians doing it, where they're just kind of, They're ranting about a thing, and it's not, where's the funny in it, you know? And so nobody wants that. So you do have to meet an audience partway.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was George Carlin, I think, who said you want to take the audience on some kind of journey, and you want them to thank you for taking them there.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think that was just limited to his kind of style of comedy. I think that's all comedy. If you can bring the audience into your world for a while, and make them feel like that was a fun thing to do, that was the good thing to do, then you've done your job, you know. And I think that's, you know, like I think I've explored a lot of different cultures by watching comedians talk about their experience. You know, you learn a lot by watching Dave Chappelle or listening to somebody like Wanda Sykes talking about, you're like, oh yeah, there's this whole other world that as a white man I'm not involved in, I don't see on a daily basis. So you're being pulled into their world, and if it's funny and fun and the comic is able to kind of meet in a midway kind of area, it's great.
Humor can be a great equalizer. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Excellent. Normally what I like to do to tail end the show is typically talk about, basically given an opportunity to sort of recommend to any listeners of this show, anybody else that you think, that they should check out, like if they could go on YouTube and look up 5 minutes of someone's comedy or or look up a band, for example, or just anything that's sort of been piquing your interest lately, like a book you're reading. Do you have any recommendations, anyone you want to pay it forward to?
In particular, like checking out on YouTube and stuff, a fellow comedian in Vancouver named Charlie Demers.
Okay.
Just so consistently smart and funny, and he's a very animated figure when he's on stage. So it's just exciting to watch him. And I've had the pleasure of knowing him, you know, throughout his career. And he's always been, he was funny from the get, you know, like he was funny from the very start. And so watching him evolve and change over the years has been really like super gratifying. And I feel like he maybe doesn't have, you know, as wide an audience as I think he should.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Charlie Demers is a great guy to check out. If you like comedy, he's got a political bent to him, but it doesn't overcome the comedy.
Yeah.
And, so I would say, for him, for sure, check out him. Also, If you're ever in Vancouver, a friend of mine named Alicia Tobin.
Okay.
She does a show called Come Draw With Me, and it is the greatest. It's just, she gets everybody in the audience to draw something.
Okay.
And then she goes through the drawings one by one, and it's just, it's magic. It's so much fun. It's so inviting.
Yeah.
So if you're ever in Vancouver, she does it once a month, at a place, at a like an art gallery.
Okay.
And, I don't know if there's any of it online yet, but it's just such a warm, fun, funny kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I think people should check that out.
You do a comedy night where you give away, like different items from thrift shops.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the Laugh Gallery. I've been hosting that in one form or another for almost 12 years.
Oh my God.
I know. And it's fun. I still do it because it's fun and I get to buy these things and give them away. And, that's every Monday I do that at a place called Havana.
All right.
And, there's so many, you know what? There's so many good things out there. The Pajama Men. Have you ever heard of the Pajama Men?
I've never heard of the Pajama Men.
No. They're a two-person sketch duo. They do hour-long shows kind of in the fringe circuit. They're in, you know, huge in Edinburgh. They're amazing. They're mind-blowingly good.
Yeah.
Peter and Chris is another sketch duo that is based out of Vancouver and Toronto.
Okay.
And their one-hour show I just saw in Toronto was just so funny and inventive. So, I mean, you know, there's too much. There's too much there's going on.
Too much going on.
There's too
on
much good stuff.
In the world of comedy.
Yeah.
Life is like Edinburgh. There's just too much going on.
It's too much. You gotta pick a few things and that's all you're gonna see.
Yeah. Exactly. And how was the fringe circuit for you this year? I know you did a show.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was in this great venue that was, had a great location and like was a super nice, you know, it was something I could fill up.
Yeah.
So that was nice to have a theater that I, you know, felt was proportionate to what I was doing. And, it was mostly sold out and good reviews. So it was good. It was a good time.
Nice.
Yeah.
What was the nature of the show? I didn't get a chance to read about it.
It was stand up. And then I also gave away prizes like I do at the Laugh Gallery.
Nice.
And then, that was the show, you know, it wasn't a narrative show. It was just supposed to be an hour of, you know, fun comedy.
Yeah, having a chance to sort of use the audience expectation of a theater crowd and explore what you can do with comedy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because it is, it's Dave, you don't have to be quite as rapid fire as you would in a comedy club.
No.
So you get to let bits breathe a bit and see where that takes you.
And no bachelorette parties, right?
No bachelorette parties, not a one.
Do you ever have bachelorette parties when you're giving things away at the Havana?
No, because we're a Monday night show, so there's not too many bachelorette parties out on Monday night. But I've dealt with lots of bachelorette parties in my life. And,
fair enough. Yeah.
You know, I feel whatever.
I feel like I've seen bachelorette parties out on a Monday in Winnipeg, so.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah. I mean, yeah, anything's possible.
It's not a white whale, but it's certainly.
No, exactly.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for doing the show. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, enjoy the rest of your stay in Winnipeg.
I will do.
Excellent. All right.
Cheers. Thank you.
Cheers.
It's nice to meet you. I know what you've been through, 'cause I have been there too. Tell me your secrets, I promise to keep them, I won't hold it to you.
Alright, so thank you so much to Graham Clark for doing that episode. Also, thank you so much to you guys for listening. If you want to see a picture of Graham as a skeleton performing stand-up comedy, go to twitter.com and look up at Graham Clark. You can follow him on there just so he can spook you out every time you log in. Also, if you want to see pictures of Graham performing stand-up comedy for a bunch of taxidermied animals, go to grahamclark.com. You can also keep up with his tour dates and any upcoming appearances on there as well. So thank you, Graham, for being part of the show. Oh, also check out Stop Podcasting Yourself. It comes out every Monday. It's hosted by Graham Clark and his good friend Dave Shumka. Subscribe to them on iTunes, and by all means, give them all the love they deserve, because those guys, they do a hell of a job. That about wraps it up for me this week. Thank you so much to everyone for tuning in. Remember, if you want to follow me, I'm at Mr. Matt Moskal on Twitter. Follow the show at TSA Pod on Twitter. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, anything you want to address, email me at tsapodcast@gmail.com. Follow us on iTunes, give us some stars or some likes or whatever it is that people, you know, trade as internet commodities these days. Leave some comments if you have any. Just don't be an asshole. I know that goes without saying, but this is the internet we're talking about here. Our theme music and interstitial music is performed by Tyson Brinacombe. You can check out his latest release, actually, on labelfantastic.com. He has a new album out called Casio Fiasco, which he recorded in Guelph's Little Room Laboratories, which is actually a studio that he helps run. The music you're hearing behind us is It's Nice to Meet You, as performed by the band Nesa off of their record, The Troubled Heart EP. Now you can check out their latest song, How I'm Feeling Lately, from their upcoming EP titled Losing Weight on www.nesa.bandcamp.com. Just a fantastic band. They're doing the festival tour circuit right now, and I wish them the best. So that's it for me. Remember, support your local everything, and everybody's gotta open for somebody sometime, right? Cheers.